All right. Do we have all the quizzes? We're going to start talking about development today. Before we do that, this was the slide at the end of the last lecture. I want you to realize how this is sort of making a major point about end-brain connections. It's dividing it into basically the same way we divided the midbrain and diencephalon, somatic and limbic types of connections, one connected with hypothalamus and the other bypassing that. But just to give you an idea how much detail it lives out, for example, I didn't put the ventral striatum in there. I just lumped it together with limbic system, but actually that's a part of the striatum, probably the most primitive part that the striatum evolved from. It's part of the striatum, and it's also part of the limbic system. So it's critical in habit formation. And another thing is, nothing in that diagram tells you anything about reward and punishment that's so critical to habit formation and perhaps higher kinds of learning too. For that, we think we need ascending projections. And one thing we know that must respond to is feedback, reward, and punishment. From example, from taste, we tend to repeat our approach in eating of things that taste good, and we avoid things that cause pain. So this, I've not given you this picture because I don't want you to learn it. I'm kidding. But what I'm trying to say is I want you to realize that it's got some complications. So I've just added the ventral striatum here, and I'm showing how it's related. It's part of the limbic, intimately connected with limbic system structures, other parts of the limbic system. It also does get a neocortical input, although the neocortex tends to be fairly weakly connected to limbic structures. It's linked to the dorsal striatum, and it gets input from the brainstem that we think represent this pathway here, represent those reward mechanisms. And those kinds of projections go also to the dorsal striatum, and there are similar types of projections, widespread projections, that go to the whole neocortex. Okay, so this is your, I've given you this handout for today. And rather than start right out with development, I'm going to go over something that's relevant to your writing project, because you were given this nice reading from the Eckert Animal Behavior book, but I want to give you a critique of that, because it's a very confusing topic, trying to distinguish fixed action patterns and reflexes, but there's been articles appearing in the research literature about that. Let's go through the 6 points quickly. He says they're complex motor acts, not simple reflexes. But there are exceptions to that. If we take the swallowing reflex, and we're going to talk about that a little later when we talk about motor control, it's very complex. You know, at least 13 different muscle groups. They all fire in particular, they contract in particular pattern. It's a complex behavior, whereas the eye blink is very simple. And yet, swallowing is more reflex-like than eye blink in many ways. They both have an endogenous component, which is like other fixed action patterns. One is complex and one is simple. Both, however, are pretty quick, and many fixed action patterns take more time, and that's one of the things that may separate them. People have argued that fixed action patterns are simply polysynaptic reflexes. So the complexity, the first word here, is the main thing that in these people's mind distinguishes it. But I think it does stretch the concept of reflexes a bit. Reflexes are not only quicker, but they're not influenced very much by drive states. Escape and fear responses may be exceptions, but we can think of those kinds of responses, many of which are fixed action patterns, are drive states triggered by the stimuli. And that's the way Conrad Lorenz treated it. And I'm basing most of what I'm saying on Conrad Lorenz. If any of you want to look at this, it's an excellent book. It's not too well known because it's difficult, but it's a very good animal behavior book, probably one of the best. It was published, it was the last book he wrote before he died. Okay, another property was its fixed action patterns are typically elicited by specific key stimuli. Now, this is true of reflexes too, but the key stimuli in the case of fixed action patterns are usually more complex. Okay. The all or none property of fixed action patterns distinguishes them from reflexes. Now, this is where I think the one point where Eckert goes is wrong, basically. And I know where the argument comes from. Once what the all or none property is it means when you trigger a fixed action pattern, the action pattern is executed without any sensory feedback. The whole thing usually goes off once it's triggered. That's actually true of reflexes too. They're ballistic in nature. But if you're going to explain a temporal pattern of movement, okay, and you want to do it in terms of simple reflexes, then you need feedback. You need to trigger a whole chain of reflexes. And that's really what Eckert should be talking about there. A fixed action pattern, it's a more complex program movement sequence. If you assume reflexes are always very brief, then of course to get a more complicated movement, you would have to have a series of reflexes involving a series of stimuli. And that was an old idea that people that were reflexologists that believed everything was a reflex. They thought that, well, every reflex that's triggered leads to new stimuli, so then that triggers the next, and so on and so on and so on. So there had to be a chain of reflexes. Now, that's been shown not to be the truth, not to be the case for many movement patterns. Okay, but that's really where that argument comes. It's hidden in there. He says that stimulus thresholds for fixed action patterns vary. The stimulus threshold varies with the state of the animal. That's very true, because like a fixed action pattern related to eating can much more readily be triggered when the animal is hungry than when he's not, things like that. But reflex thresholds also vary quite a bit with the state. But for fixed action patterns, the influences are very large, and their drive states or motivational states are regulated in them more than just stimulus history. Stimulus history is more important for reflexes. The last two are certainly true for fixed action patterns. They're nearly identical movements for all members of a species, and often for members of larger groups as well. That's also true of reflexes. Genetically inherited, these are as much a characteristic of a species as the shape of his hands and his face and everything else. In other words, it's as good as a morphological feature in characterizing an animal. You could say the same thing for reflexes. The so-called unconditioned or unconditional reflexes of Pavlov are all genetically inherited. Okay, so let's just run through the neuroanatomy we've learned. I just want to point out the major points. You can use this outline to test how much you remember. We went through the subdivisions of the central nervous system, and we defined some major cell types. Remember, primary sensory neuron, secondary sensory neuron, motor neuron, and interneuron. We also showed the shape of the neural tube at various levels, and I was using the embryonic neural tube, but we saw a few pictures from the more mature nervous system as well. We talked about sensory channels. Remember, reflex channel, cerebellar channel, lemniscal channels, two major ones, and we talked about their origin for the somatosensory system and the dermatome, so you should know what that means. We talked about functional things, and when you're evaluating lesion effects, you need to know about dyschisis, the lesion-produced deafferentation that can result in functional depression of neurons, and that depends on the quantity of excitatory inputs removed. And we talked about recovery from diaschesis. We mentioned a couple mechanisms. We talked about the expansion of neocortex in evolution and the major ascending and descending pathways to and from it. The corticospinal pathway, which actually goes to various levels, not only the spinal cord, and the ascending pathways from the dorsal column, medial meniscus system, from the spinal cord. Other sensory systems have such pathways too, but we haven't talked about them yet. Then we went to spinal cord structure, mentioned some major differences between different levels, defined the proprio-spinal system, and we discussed the autonomic nervous system, sympathetic, parasympathetic, and the enteric nervous system, which can be thought of as part of the parasympathetic. And then we went to hindbrain organization and some of the distortions of that basic plan that occur with development, especially of the cerebellum. We didn't talk a lot about the cranial nerves except for the fifth, the trigeminal nerve carrying input from the face, because that's most like a dorsal root. The fibers come through the trigeminal ganglion. That's where the primary sensory neurons are. So you should review that. Then we went on to the higher parts of the brain, first the midbrain. I showed you a picture, and we talked about in species how the species differ in the size of the midbrain tectum, especially with the more visual animals having much larger tectum. And we also showed the picture of the all the structures below it. That's usually called the tegmentum, the midbrain tegmentum. I'm sorry I didn't use that word before. That's basic. The shape of the midbrain and how it varies in species. Then the tweenbrain or diencephalon, two major functional subdivisions related to the somatic and limbic systems, and then the major structural parts, and we emphasize just two of them, the thalamus and hypothalamus. Then we talked about the endbrain, the telencephalon, which can are made up of the cerebral hemispheres and the basal forebrain, also the olfactory bulbs in front of that. And I mentioned the origin of two major pathways for descending axons. There are ascending axons in both of those pathways too. They were called the lateral and the medial forebrain bundles. The lateral forebrain bundle often isn't called that except by embryologists and specialized neuroanatomists. Comparative neuroanatomists comparing different species. Usually we call it by the fibers that belong there. And we mention a number of the names, especially for the fibers that come from the neocortex going towards the spinal cord. I emphasize mainly these pathways, spinothalamic, dorsal column, connecting to the medial meniscus, to the ventral basal nucleus of the thalamus, also called ventral posterior. And then we talked about the corticospinal and the corticopontine pathways. So when you go through these lists of things, if you're really fuzzy in your knowledge about it, go back, find the part of the lecture where we talked about it, read about them, and please ask if you don't think you're understanding something. We won't think you're dumb. I had, I'm sure, more questions than you have. But that's one reason I learned it, because I found it so confusing at the beginning. It was a challenge. Okay, development of the nervous system. We're going to divide it up this way. A little simpler than your textbook. Neurulation, which we've already talked about, we're talking about again today, the formation of the neural tube. And then proliferation of cells, the multiplication of cells as they increase in number in early development, the migration of cells to their final locations, and then the differentiation of the neuron with the growth of the processes, axons and dendrites. Now the textbook shows actually subdivides the process of differentiation a little further this way. They leave out neurulation. I'm giving you a broader picture of development than the textbook. But I just want to point out that the textbook, after they talk about proliferation, they're just calling it mitosis here, or neurogenesis is another name, the genesis of neurons, neurogenesis, and migration of cells, differentiation. And then they go further with differentiation to talk about what's happening when these processes are growing. Synapses form. Some cells are dying. And then synapses actually rearrange as a normal part of development. Okay. But all of this doesn't happen in sequence quite this way. It's happening pretty much simultaneously. It's part of differentiation process. Okay, now you remember this picture. And it's showing it here in the Xenopus embryo just before neurulation, formation of the nervous system. We know that it's going to appear right here in this embryo. So if you did a cross-section there, what would you see? Can you tell me? It's not just a plain egg. There's something in there. Otherwise, you're not going to get a nervous system forming. What induces the formation of the nervous system? And then when we see it, just look at it here. You see it happening here. You should be able to see from that it starts to form. It's a little more advanced in one part than the rest. What part is forming last? Well, the neural tube is closing last, way up at this end and way down at the other end. Okay, so it starts, the neural tube closes first in the cervical spinal cord level. So if I asked you just from that, what part of the brain do you think forms earliest or gets started earliest, matures earliest, what would you guess? The hindbrain, that's right. In fact, the caudal part of the hindbrain. In this class, I usually talk about the whole hindbrain together, but sometimes I talk about the rostral hindbrain where the cerebellum is. In some books, they subdivide the hindbrain into two parts, and they give Latin names, and the metencephalon and the myelencephalon. Okay, I won't require you to know that. Often, the name for the myelencephalon is the medulla oblongata. The medulla spinalis is the name for the spinal cord in Latin. Okay, and so the elongated cord is the hindbrain. Okay, but hindbrain is good enough for this class. Okay, so this is another kind of picture that shows what you were seeing there in the movie was what we call neurulation. And it shows here a dorsal picture of it, of an amphibian, so it could be the same type of animal as you saw in the film, where you're starting to get, you've got a thickened neural plate here, shown in green. And here you see it in a longitudinal section. It's the neural plate. Okay, it's thickening and then it invaginates. Okay, and that's how the neural tube is forming. And it's showing here the part that will be forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain, and then spinal cord. Now what's happened before that is it was a blastula. Initially it was a morula, like a little raspberry, a clump of cells. Okay, and then it became, it had a space in the middle, a fluid-filled space. That was the blastula. Okay, and then you have gastrulation. What happens is the ventral part here, now this is a dorsal view of it, a surface view. What happens is that the part that's going to form the endoderm, which forms all the viscera, okay, forms a dimple, and cells move in. So here in a cross-section, you see the earlier invagination. Now, this is not the neurulation. This is not the cord. That, where this is happening, is where the anus is going to be, and the cells move across to the opposite side, so you end up with a tube. Not the neural tube, the whole organism is a tube. You are a tube. The openings are the anus and the mouth. Okay, so that's what's happening here. That's what gastrulation is, and that's how you get the layering, the primitive layering. So with the ectoderm on the surface, the mesoderm and the endoderm. And of course, the kinds of cell-cell signaling that's going on when this is happening is still being investigated. It's very complex. And it happens about the same way in all of the vertebrates. Okay, in fact, much of it happens in vertebrates as well. Analogous things. So now let's go back to neurulation in the formation of the neural tube. We'll mention the discovery of induction of the central nervous system by the notochord region, with the discovery of particular molecules that do the inducing and additional molecules that influence the later determination of what those cells in the neural tube are going to be. It's the influence of the notochord that causes the ectoderm above it to thicken, and that's the neural plate. Okay, and then the cells nearest the notochord behave a little differently than the cells a little farther from it in the neural plate, and that is what causes an invagination. The cells are changing in shape. Okay, that causes the neural groove, and then as the invagination is completed, you get the neural tube with the neural crest cells, and this is the way I pictured it. Here's the thickening neural plate, and remember, it's one cell thick. The cells are changing in shape. These cells are now longer cells than these out here, the ones that will be skin. Okay, so those are all ectodermal cells. The influence is coming from the mesoderm here, the notochord. And that causes the neural groove to form. Now here's the neural plate. And notice now the cells there that are nearest the notochord, they're being influenced by something, okay? They're going to form the ventral part of the neural tube. The ones nearest will be the floor plate. Those furthest from it, but still part of the neural tube, will end up as dorsal spinal cord and roof plate. And the neural crest cells will be the ones that are left outside. Tom Jessel and his co-workers at Columbia a few years ago discovered that a particular molecule, and there were others that have also come upon this, and there's been many investigations of this molecule and other molecules that are involved. It has a sort of neat name, sonic hedgehog. It's a protein that comes from the notochord, and it functions as a ventralizing factor. It influences the differentiation of the basal plate cells, and the basal plate cells then start secreting this molecule also, and the neurons, it diffuses through the cord, and the ones nearest are differentiated into motor neurons. The ones that get a little less of it differentiate into the ventral horn interneurons. There's another inducing influence that's been discovered, and these are the main components of it, that come from that ectoderm adjacent to the neural plate. Okay, these are called BMP4 and 7. BMP means the bone morphogenetic protein because of other functions that it has. So sonic hedgehog is here. BMP4 and 7 are coming from here. Okay, so sonic hedgehog is affecting the nearby parts of the neural tube. That's a dorsalizing factor because this is going to become the dorsal part or inner plate region of the neural tube, whereas sonic hedgehog is coming from the notochord, which will form the floor plate, and that molecule will also influence the nearby cells of the basal plate. Okay, so we can see that, and we've seen this before. Oops, wrong button. Okay, so it doesn't show the inducing molecules, but this is happening because of what's coming from the notochord initially. That causes the thickening and then the invagination. Okay. The other influence is from here, and it's already happening right at this stage. And it affects the future of those cells. Now, when you see this happening, you should know when it starts to close here, what the cross-section looks like, and then how that progresses. Know what the neural crest is doing. It's going to form the paravertebral ganglia down here. That is the sympathetic chain of ganglia. And up here we'll get the neural crest cells. And there's other cells there too, remember. They're not all neurons coming from neural crest. It includes other structures as well, particularly melanocytes in the skin. Okay, so let's now talk about the next stage when the neurons start to proliferate. Initially, the neural tube is one cell thick. Okay. By proliferation, we mean mitoses, which for much of the nervous system and certainly in the spinal cord happen adjacent to the ventricle. But we said it's one cell thick. So we have to see what we mean then, that it's adjacent to the ventricle. We call that layer of cells near the ventricle the matrix layer of the developing spinal cord. That means the mother layer. Okay. And cells divide in two different ways. Initially, we just have symmetric cell division, and that means when mitosis occurs, the two daughter cells both remain in a proliferative state. So they are stem cells. Okay. With asymmetric cell division, one of the daughter cells is finished with its mitosis. It becomes post-mitotic. And that's the cell that migrates. Okay. What happens to the other one? That stays a stem cell. It's going to undergo mitosis again. Now, if we look at these cells, it's hard in the Golgi stain, as seen by Cajal, to understand quite what's going on there. Let's just... I'm sorry, I don't have the tablet today, so I'll have to draw on the board. Let's say these are the walls of the neural tube. Let's do it here. Now, this could be anywhere on the wall of the neural tube. Now, we said it's one cell thick when this kind of thing is happening. What that means is that the cells are elongated, okay? Just as we see in that picture by Cajal, okay? And different cells will have the cell body at various places there, but the cell will stretch out between the peel surface here and the ventricular surface here. Okay, now, all the cells are like that. Now let's see what happens when mitosis occurs. Okay, what happens, and we're going to go to the right here, that cell will round up. That means it loses the outer process. Okay, and there it is now sitting next to the ventricle. That's a cell that's about to undergo mitosis. Okay, so it does so. And of course the result is two cells. Then these cells each re-extend their process. Okay. Now that's leaving out some of the movement. Okay. The cell, after it connects again, so it's now we're back to this part of the cycle. When it synthesizes its DNA, the cell body moves out along that process up here someplace. And then it synthesizes its DNA, and then it moves back to the ventricle. That's called a to-and-fro migration, but it's not the kind of migration we're going to talk about in the post-mitotic cell. Okay, that's part of the mitotic cycle. Okay, synthesizes DNA, and then it moves up to the ventricle, undergoes mitosis, re-extends its process, and then the cycle starts over again. Okay? Yes? This is the ventricle here. Okay? Here, this is the ventricle. and that's the peel surface. So let's go back to the picture here. This is the ventricular surface. These are the elongated cells. Okay, so that ventricular surface I've shown at the bottom here. The peel surface is the outer surface. The central nervous system is covered by a kind of cell we call a peel cell. Okay, it's not a neuronal cell. So when I talk about the peel surface, I mean the outer surface of the brain, of the central nervous system. Okay. And here's a Cajal picture of an elongated cell. He's calling it the neuroepithelium, the primitive neuroepithelium is sometimes used to designate the early neural tube. And he's seeing these elongated cells. Now, the fact that he sees two nuclei in some of them may mean that, in fact, his Golgi stain is staining two cells and he's not able to separate them. Or it may be he's dealing with non-neuronal cells. Okay. So the slides here will just go through some of what I just said. We call it a pseudo-stratified epithelium because when you look at a typical cell stain, what you're seeing is the nucleus and region of the nucleus. Okay, you often don't stain the processes. So it can look like there's multiple layers. But in fact, it's really one layer. That's why you call it pseudo-stratified, because most of the cells, in fact, are connected to both the outer and the inner membranes. And then the cell nucleus moves within the elongated cell. And it moves during the steps of cell division. And that's proliferation. And then later it will move in a different way by migration of the postmitotic cell. Okay? Let me finish the story here. I mentioned what I do with my chalk. Okay. Start out here with our elongated cell again. Let's just define symmetric and asymmetric cell division. I drew symmetric cell division there. Okay, where both cell, these are the postmitotic cells, but they're both going to undergo mitosis again. Okay? So they divided symmetrically. They didn't end up any different. They're really identical twins, those two daughters. But cells can divide and not be identical. Once you know that, then you know why identical twins in people may not be identical. They may end up a little different, depending on the way the cell divides. So let's talk about asymmetric division. We're not going to go through the molecular processes to show you what happens. Okay, it undergoes mitosis, just as I showed before. And now, because of the way it divided, okay, one of them will extend its process. They'll both extend the process. But this one keeps on going, goes further from the ventricle, and doesn't come back to undergo mitosis. Okay? Whereas this one will lose this process, undergo mitosis again. Okay, that's asymmetric cell division. The cell actually splits in a different plane, and so you get an asymmetric division of certain molecules inside the cell, and that makes the subsequent history different. All right, so now what about that migration? I said the postmitotic cell moves away. We say that's migration. Question? Very good question. That's what we're going to talk about. She wants to know, when that moves, what's moving? Does the whole cell move? Does just the process move? Well, both. Migration is of different types. In nuclear translocation, okay, the cell reestablishes its connections with the pleural surface and maintains the connection with the ventricular surface. And the migration is really just a translocation of the nucleus within that process. It later will lose those primitive connections. We don't call those primitive processes axons or dendrites. Okay, they're just the primitive processes of the cell. Migration, when it goes over long distances, especially in the neocortex, we know happens a little differently. The distances simply get too great for the axon to, for the cell to move, to maintain those connections to the pia and the ventricular surface. So even though the intracellular dynamics are pretty similar, the cell is moving along cells that do maintain those connections. Okay, the glial, radial glial cells. We'll look at a picture of that. And there's other kinds of migration too, where that are a little more like an amoeba moving through the substrate. Okay, along a substrate, there's the cell movement can be guided by other substrate factors other than the radial glial cells. For example, in the cerebellum, in the early, the movement. Remember, I talked about the cells from the inner plate region that migrate up into the roof plate. Okay, that's not happening along radial cells. Okay, it's being guided though by an adhesive substrate. The whole cell is moving, and it is not connected to the ventricular and pleural surface the way it is in nuclear translocation. These are some of the Cajal pictures that show these elongated cells, just so you know they're real. And the Golgi stain will pick up only certain cells. You can see the shorter ones here in the floor plate, in the roof plate, the longer ones in the thickening neural tube. But he didn't get a single cell here that's lost its connections. In this particular stain, a 3-day-old chick spinal cord, all of them still have those connections. And when he started... Oh, this was still the same day, but in this time, his stain worked a little differently, and he was getting motor neurons. He's also getting some axons growing in from the dorsal root. You can see some dorsal root cells here, sending axons towards the cord, and a few of them are penetrating the cord. Even when these axons start to grow out, so we know they're motor neurons, they're growing out of cells that are still elongated. He doesn't show that clearly here, but we know from many of his pictures that that's true. The processes can start to indicate the differentiation of a neuron, even though the cell still looks like this. The primitive processes still exist. See, here's a little bit later from the chick, and you see how the cells are getting longer and longer and a little more complex, but they're still maintaining those connections. This is from a human lumbar cord, and it's getting really thick, and even at this stage, many of the cells are still connected to the pia and the ventricular surface, but some of them have lost a connection. Look at this one. See, it's lost its connection there, but it still has the connection out here. And you see that more and more. There was a lot of argument when it was discovered that, and I'm going to have to do this next time, I want to go through the argument about why we know that there are multiple types of migration. Because when it was discovered that cells move along glial cells, everybody thought then, now we know how cells migrate and find their way. But in fact, nuclear translocation is still a major way cells migrate in parts of the nervous system, and I'll go through the discovery that convinced everyone of that at the beginning of the next hour. I needed it.
Yeah, sorry.